stage two, that's manifestor level. Mm-hmm. That means I actually see the life that I want to live. I see it visually. I feel it. I have an emotional bond with it until it manifests. Visioning is different. Visioning says there's something within me that I can't see. It's beyond my imagination. I want that to come forward.
It's the life force?
Yes, it's the life force. It's my unique pattern.
Okay.
It's beyond societal fantasy. It's beyond parental fantasy. In other words, your mother may have had a dream about you and wanted you to be a doctor. The society wants you to act a certain way. But there's something that's been placed there by God. And when you go into the visioning process, you're actually opening yourself up to that which is unique to you to express.
So it's not a physical vision or visualization. Like, visualization is like, I imagine myself to be
in Hawaii, or you imagine yourself to have this house or this car. No, it can include that, but it transcends that. You're actually becoming in tune with your purpose.
Got it. It's a higher level.
It's a higher level.
It's a next level of unfolding.
It's a next level of unfolding.
That's what it is. It is a next level. Yeah. So it's like channeling, which is the next level of unfolding.
Yeah, being a channel, as the third stage, is I realize that I am a place through which the infinite expresses.
Oh, this is good.
You see, I'm available. So we use words like surrender, yielding, right. Mm-hmm. Allowing, letting.
Opening.
I'm available. I'm surrendered. Now, what happens? We come into frequent encounters with the zone or the flow.
Yeah.
You know, when you used to get in the flow.
Yeah.
And you didn't plan something, and it's not a part of what you tried to do, mm-hmm. but if something takes you over, that's stage three. You're in a flow now. It's like, what happened? What did I say? How did that turn out so well? Because beyond your imagination, something took you over. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And something is God, you know, something talking to you.
When you allow yourself
to
be the channel through which the infinite flows through.
Right. So stage two, you cut our teeth on stage two. You visualize. You say what you want. You do your affirmations. You set your intentions. You have to do that. And as you become a master at that level, then you start to find yourself in a moment you think not.
Well,
something happened.
Yeah.
In a moment you think not, you become available. You become a channel for such beauty and greatness and love and giving and creativity.
And then by stage four, are like, all the time.
I don't know if it's all the time.
It's like agape on a Sunday morning, all the time. That's stage four.
Yeah, you feel you're at one with God, you know, and it doesn't take away from God. As a matter of fact, to limit the presence of God is to blaspheme the presence, you see. So you just feel connected. It's a connection.
Yeah.
And that's stage four, is my life is the life of God. Because there's no other life outside of God. God is infinite.
Who can live in that all the time? I love it. I've had.
You've had moments.
Moments.
Yes.
I've had glimpses. I've had moments. I've had, you know, like little,
But
where you can feel it. But just to be there all the time.
Well,
I don't know if being there all the time is a part of this plane. Is it?
I think that you just get to higher and higher levels of it.
I would agree with that. Yes.
Yeah. And you find yourself today at a higher frequency than you were 10 years ago.
Absolutely. And if you're not, then you're not evolving on
the planet. And 10 years from now, you want to be at a higher frequency than you are now.
Thank you. Thanks for blessing us with your words and your presence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chapter 5, Ego. Ego is an imposter, imposing on the real you, making you think you are something that you're not. True self-esteem is realizing that the stillness and presence in me is the same as the presence in all people. The conversations I've shared with renowned thought leader and spiritual teacher Eckhart Tolle have been some of the most meaningful of my life. His wisdom has been so transformative, I keep a copy of his book, A New Earth, on my bedside table. I didn't understand the true meaning of ego until I met Eckhart. I used to think the ego presented itself as arrogance, selfishness, or feelings of superiority. But I know now that it's not always someone who's acting out or showing off. Everyone has an ego. And I believe most people aren't even aware of how it affects their daily life. Understanding the ego's constant disruption to our spiritual development is such an integral lesson in our path to awareness that it's become one of my very favorite topics to discuss on Super Soul Sunday. If you watch the show regularly, you will almost always hear me ask, what role does the ego play in this situation? This is the essential question we should all be asking ourselves whenever we encounter difficulty. As you hear the words of wisdom selected for this chapter, you will begin to understand how the answer is universal. The ego has the power to influence or derail every aspect of our lives. Accepting this as truth opens the door to where the real work begins. It was Eckhart who opened my eyes to how an ego-based mind can dominate everything. Ego represents that part of ourselves that identifies with our self-image, personality, talents, accomplishments, and perceived weaknesses. Everything that encompasses the false self. The ego draws a line and separates you from everyone else. It leads you to see the world as this is me and this is the other, when in fact, we all share the same source of spiritual energy. The ego makes judgments and longs to feel special. It loves conflict, creates enemies, and operates out of fear. In those moments, if you call your false self out by saying, oh, that's my ego flaring up, you begin to diminish its power. You begin to recognize that you are not your past, your social status, or the shape of your body. The size of your bank account has no bearing on your true self. What these conversations have taught me is that as we realize our own spiritual evolution, we have the miraculous ability to shed our current state of ego. As Eckhart Tolle says, the ego cannot exist in consciousness.
Ah, how fantastic is this? So much has changed since we did a New Earth webcast. It was just 4 years ago, 2008.
Yes.
That was considered for me and our industry groundbreaking when we were broadcasting live around the world in our first webcast. Remember that first night and people were Skyping in? We're like, oh, there's Brazil.
Yes.
That first webcast was one of the, really, I think it was a seminal day for me. Because it said that our ability to, for me, doing this kind of work, using your voice to let people come closer to the one that is their own, that was transmittable in a way around the world, in a way that we had never done before. But not only transmittable, but could actually be both physically, emotionally, and spiritually received.
Yes.
Do you think technology is accelerating our consciousness or the opposite?
I think both are happening at the moment. I can see the negative effects of technology that it has, can have, and has on many, especially young people who get addicted to their devices, the computer and the smartphones and so on.
Right.
So our mind can get totally filled up with useless facts. And so that can prevent us from actually being able to pay attention to what is here in the present moment. The most important ability a human being can have is to direct his or her full attention to the present moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there are obviously wonderful things. The fact that we can communicate now, hello world, with everybody throughout the world who is seeking this information, that's a good thing. And obviously there are dangers, particularly for people raising children in this environment.
Yeah.
One of the things that you did after the New Earth seminars, you wrote a book called Oneness with All Life, A Companion to a New Earth, which says many of the things that are in New Earth, but it's not like a summarized version of New Earth.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, this is what I loved from Oneness with All Life. This is also right next to my bed. My signed copy from you. You say, through the present moment, you have access to the power of life itself. The power of life itself. That which has traditionally been called God. Which I thought is such a beautiful definition of God. The power of life itself. As soon as you turn away from it, God ceases to be a reality in your life. And all you're left with is the mental concept of God. The mental concept, which is what a lot of people talk about.
Yes.
The mental concept of God, their belief in God. And what you go on to say is, which some people believe in and others deny, even belief in God is only a poor substitute for the living reality of God manifesting every moment of your life.
Yes.
I think that is such a beautiful offering for
yes.
Super Soul Sunday.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's stepping from belief, which is fine, going to the deeper level where belief becomes an actual realization or a knowing. And that can start with a simple thing like, and anybody can verify that in their own experience.
How?
When you take your attention into the present moment, which implies, of course, a certain alertness arises.
Yes, yes.
Which is different from thinking. Thinking compared to that is almost like a kind of dreamlike state. You're up here, not present here. So a certain alertness arises. You become more conscious of what surrounds you. But also, strangely, it's hard to talk about it, but I will, of a sense of presence that is both within and without.
Yes.
A presence. We could call that a divine presence.
Yes.
There is something.
And that presence, what everybody needs to know, is the presence that you feel when you're able to silence your mind.
Silence your mind.
And be aware of the silence that's in your mind. You are that awareness.
Yes.
Disguised as a person.
Yes. And when you become conscious of the gap between two thoughts, for example, or even now, sometimes I even recommend to people that they hold their hands like this and they create this, let's say, past is there, future is there, you let them go. Now you bring your attention to just the present. It can be a little reminder to help you hold that sense of presence.
And to recognize that the past
awareness.
Is here and the future is here.
Yes.
And that the only moment that matters is right now.
The only thing you ever
have
is now.
The only thing that matters is now.
Yes.
I mean, I learned so much from that experience with you, the 10 weeks. It was like, it was the original life class. It is from which all the other life classes have stemmed. Yeah. And one of the most important things that I learned is that we all have the ability to awaken,
yeah.
Correct?
Yes.
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 And that if we don't awaken as a species, that the species will eventually.
Yes, I see it as the next step in our evolution as a species is to embrace that state of consciousness that we call awakening.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't, then the problems that the unawakened mind has created on the planet will only increase and multiply.
One of the things that you say is that stress is wanting something to be the way that it isn't. So how do you know the difference between something isn't the way that I want it to be and I need to accept it because you say what you resist persists? How do you know whether you're supposed to accept it or try to bring about change for whatever it is that you want to change?
First, you accept, even if change is possible, and you may need to focus some attention on the situation to realize what kind of steps you can take to change the situation. But in the meantime, the basis for effective action is to come into an inner alignment with the isness of this moment. This is how it is. Let's say I gave the example in The Power of Now. I'm stuck in the mud,
yes.
Just as an example. This is the situation right now.
I'm so pissed off. I'm stuck in the mud. Damn this mud. How did I get in this mud?
Oh, yes. That. Or you become a victim in your own mind. Why did
there's always mud.
Why is this happening
here?
To me? Always to
yes.
me.
Uh-huh.
And so on. You victim identity, complaining.
Yeah. What is the mud in your life? So you're just saying, using that as a metaphor.
Yes. And so, but just look at the situation without labeling it. This is where I am right now. And you accept that this is how it is. the isness of life at
and
this moment.
And now I will begin to think about how to change it.
And then you can become actually a greater intelligence arises because you become present with what is.
So if you're stuck in the mud and you're angry about being stuck in the mud and you're trying to resolve being stuck in the mud from that point of anger, you will always remain stuck in the mud.
Yes.
You've got to remove yourself from the mud.
That's right.
I got that.
Yeah.
Okay. I think if there was only one message, because I don't want to, you know, in the short time that we have this morning to go over everything, it's impossible that we learn from New Earth. But if the essence of it, that if you wanted people to understand the reason why you sat down and wrote that book or that book wrote you, you said that book was burning inside you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The reason why you wanted to do it is because you wanted to cause an awakening. Is that it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Or one could say that it was kind of coming through me.
Yes.
So I just became the kind of almost the channel for it.
Yes.
So there was something in me that needed to write that book. And I feel the essence of a new earth and of the power of now is the arising of the state of presence.
Mm-hmm.
And now, for the first time, it is possible on a more widespread level for humans to undergo that shift in consciousness where they are no longer totally dominated by the continuous compulsive thinking in their heads, the voice that never stops talking. They are no longer totally in the grip of that because that's the old conditioned consciousness. Something new arises, an inner spaciousness and a presence, and that presence transcends who you are as a person.
That's right. And it's what you call in the books going beyond thought.
Yes.
All right. You say on page 13, see if you can catch, that is to say, notice the voice in the head. Whenever you notice that voice, you will also realize that you are not the voice, but the one who is aware of it. It's what you say in Stillness Speaks.
Mm-hmm.
You are that awareness disguised as a person.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Wow, that's big. I think, is that, would you say, is that, I know it's hard to measure your own words and your own work, but would you say that that is, in terms of awakening and realization of your personal power, that that's really one of the most important things?
Yes, that is the most important thing. Feeling it for yourself,
yes,
sensing
what one
it.
Needs to know.
So the moment you become aware that you have certain kinds of thoughts in your head, there's already that awareness arising. There's still many people in this world who are so identified with every thought that arises in their head, there's not the slightest space of awareness there.
That's right.
And they may not even be ready to hear what we are saying. It would be totally meaningless to them.
Yes. So you have to be ready to hear it. That's why you were saying, why I was saying earlier, quoting from the book, that if you hear something that connects to you, it means you're already awakening enough to be able to hear it, because it's only spirit that recognizes spirit.
Yes.
Truth recognizes truth.
Yes.
There you are.
Yes. It's the deepest sense of beingness. I sometimes ask people, can you be aware of your own presence? Not thinking, not the thoughts that you're having, not the emotions that you're having, but the very presence of your very being. You become aware of your own presence by sensing the entire energy field in your body that is alive.
Yes.
And that is the totality of your presence.
Because you know that no matter what's going on, all the trials and difficulties and challenges and whatever that all of us have from time to time in our life, that there is a space that you can go to.
Yes.
That really is the ultimate connection to all there is, or God.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. That's where you and God merge, so then you recognize your oneness with the source of life.
Of source of life.
Yes.
What I find is, if you can go to that space, that's where your strength, that's where your true strength lies.
Yes.
That's where your true creativity, your power, your ability to be authentically yourself.
Yes.
Everything comes from that space, and
yes,
you want to be able to bring that space to everything that you do.
Yes.
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 And bring that space forward to inhabit who you are.
Yes.
To be conscious of that.
Yes.
Yeah. I got that.
Yeah.
I got that.
Yeah.
This is one of my favorite quotes from page 64. You do not become good by trying to be good, but by finding the goodness that is already within you and allowing that goodness to emerge. Again, we're talking about going to presence, the divine within you, and bringing that forth to whatever it is you do.
Yes. Because trying to be good is often to improve one's self-image.
Right. That's ego-driven.
Ultimately, it's ego. So you try, and some people, for example, have been trying for centuries to love their neighbor as themselves.
Right.
But most of them have been finding it very difficult. Because love your neighbor as yourself really means, first of all, you need to be in touch with yourself, the self that you are beyond the form, the consciousness that you are. And then you can love your neighbor as yourself because you recognize your oneness with your neighbor.
Yeah. And so what you're saying is, that's so beautiful. I get it. Lots of bing, bing, ahas here. You're not, love your neighbor as yourself, as you're interpreting it, is not as yourself, the personality.
No.
Not as yourself who's out there mowing the lawn. Not as yourself. See, it doesn't mean if you go to the theater, give your neighbor tickets to the theater or whatever. It means the deeper always.
Yes.
Inner self.
Yes.
Higher self.
Yes. So love, I call love the recognizing yourself in the other. And yourself, your essential self, is consciousness.
Got it.
Then I begin, when I then meet people and interact with people, I see them on two levels, or feel them on two levels. On one level, they are the form.
Yes.
Which is the body and their psychological makeup.
Correct.
On another level, they are the consciousness that I also am, because underlying the body and the mind is the consciousness out of which the body and the mind have come. And that is still there, that pure essence.
You see that in every person that you encounter?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that makes it much easier to interact with people and much more pleasant, because sometimes the personality, the psychological makeup, is not that wonderful.
Yes.
And then one is able to let that be, because you can sense that beyond that, there is an essence to that human being.
That's what I mean when I am going into interviews, particularly that I think might be, you know, challenging, I will consciously meditate on the thought of the presence in me, speak to the presence in you.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because that's what I'm really looking for.
Yes.
That underlying thing.
Yes.
And that we all have, that oneness that we all have.
That's right.
Which, as you know, that's when you get the best conversation.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What is your own personal spiritual practice? Do you have one?
I don't have a practice as such. It's.
Do you meditate?
Not in a formal sense, but sometimes I sit and just be without doing anything.
Yeah. I want everybody to know that you can just do that.
In stillness, you get closest to the source of life, which is God, and which is essentially yourself.
Which is the One.
The One.
I love calling God the One now. The One.
Yeah.
I know you told my producers that it's wonderful to meditate. You have meditated. Sometimes you do meditate.
Yes.
But meditation isn't the end-all, be-all, because there are a lot of people who go in and meditate, and there's 20 minutes of let me connect to presence.
Yes.
Then they get up from that 20 minutes, and they are unconscious the rest of the 23:40, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So their daily life is not interspersed with presence and space.
Mm-hmm.
That's why often...
That's like people who go to church on Sunday and then leave church and come home and kick the dog.
Yes.
Yes.
That's why I often say if you... meditation is, of course, wonderful. It's not for everybody.
Yes.
But for many people...
It's not for everybody,
For many people, it will be very helpful.
Yeah.
But even more important than meditation, and especially those people who don't meditate and don't want to meditate, bring in little spaces of aware presence into everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
Choose a few things that you use as vehicles for bringing in presence. For example, when you get into your car, you close the door. Why not spend 30 seconds just, for example, being aware of your breathing, which is another beautiful way of bringing that inner space, that presence into your life.
Yes.
30 seconds is not that much. Even the busiest person can do that.
Yes.
if they believe their minds, which their mind might say, I have no time for this now, but you don't have to believe every thought that comes into your head.
Because it's just a thought.
Yes.
Tell that thought, be gone with you. You have no power here.
You don't have to believe every thought that comes into your head.
You don't. Because it's just a thought.
Yeah.
That's right.
For many people, no sense of spaciousness, presence inside at all. It's like living in a room that's crammed full with furniture.
Yes. And I think of people who live their whole lives, and hopefully this opportunity to join us on Super Soul Sunday starts to give a little crack of the space for people.
Yes. Yeah,
that's my whole heart's desire, is to do that for people.
Yes.
What is the soul?
The soul is one of the words one can use to talk about your innermost being, the presence that you are beyond form, that which underlies the personality and the mind, the essence of who you are.
Have you always considered yourself a spiritual person, or did you have an aha moment when you recognize your connection to something bigger than yourself?
I had a big aha moment where I disidentified from my mind and disidentified from the unhappy self that I was.
You were suicidal.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So there was a mind-created unhappy sense of self, and somehow I separated from it. It happened, just happened. And realized that that is not who I am.
Was that was that what people call a nervous breakdown?
It was a state of acute anxiety, which could have become a nervous breakdown or could have become suicide. So it was moving in that direction.
It was moving in that direction, where you literally separated. And tell the story one more time.
Well, the thought, I was in bed at night again, where a lot of the mental suffering happens for many people at night. Couldn't sleep and plagued by dreadful thoughts. And the thought arose, I can't live with myself any longer. I can't live with myself any longer. And then there must have come some awareness, although I didn't know what it was at the time. And the awareness looked at the thought and said, what does that mean, I can't live with myself? Are there two? Who is the I and who is the self that I cannot live with? That question came up. The answer didn't come on the level of words. There was just, the answer came as a separation suddenly of the self that I couldn't live with and the I. And the I was consciousness.
The awareness.
And the self was created by thoughts and emotions.
Yes, all those thoughts in the head. Yeah.
Then I recognized myself as consciousness, and so the self began to dissolve. The false sense of self, the unhappy me, the unhappy sense of self kind of crumbled. And all I knew suddenly, the next day I woke up, everything is so peaceful. It took me years to understand what that actually was, that I had disidentified from the unhappy self and I was simply there as a perceiving presence, which is a deeply peaceful way of being. It was in London, England. So I walked around the streets going, wow, everything is so beautiful. There was just perceiving and peace underneath.
Did your friends think you were nuts?
Some did. Yeah. My mother did. Uh-huh. Especially when I then later walked out of my normal life.
So they all thought, Eckhart has lost his mind.
Yes.
And in a way, you right. did. You did. They were right. You did. How do you define spirituality versus religion? What's the difference?
You can have religion with spirituality. You can also have religion without spirituality. Some people are so closely identified with their belief structure, they're really completely trapped in thinking. And so there's no spaciousness. What we are doing here can actually be part of any religion.
Any religion, absolutely.
So as
it
long as
it can enhance the religion that you currently follow.
Yes, deepen it.
Deepen it.
Yes.
Yeah.
For example, in Christianity, any Christian who wants to go deeper into their own religion and does not want to abandon their religion, there is enormous depth in Christian teaching in the words of Christ.
Absolutely. Everything that Christ came to teach is spirituality.
That's right.
That's what it is.
Yes.
Christ came to make manifest spirituality
exactly.
on earth.
Yes.
What does prayer mean to you? Do you pray?
There's a saying that goes, if you talk to God, you pray. If God talks to you, you're insane. So it's very unlikely that God will speak to you in words, mm-hmm. but...
Because God speaks through stillness.
Yes.
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 That's where you find God.
Yes.
The Bible says, be still and know
yes.
that I am God.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think prayer to me could be called, I'm often in the state of listening, which really is an aspect of presence when you're just
yes.
receptive.
That is your prayer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like that. I can be like, it's a wonderful just enjoying the presence that is there when you're not thinking and just being, just like this. And then when you become present, you become aware of a presence, a divine presence, mm-hmm. both within and without.
Yes, in all things.
And that's why this is, I call it also prayer.
Prayer. So where do you feel most at home or at peace?
Wherever I am, in the stillness, mm. that is wherever I go, the stillness is there. That's my home. I actually feel that, being rooted in that as my home.
So are you always happy, Eckhart?
I don't call it happy, although I have used happy occasionally in the mm. book, but it's more a state of peaceful aliveness.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you lost your ego?
Yes.
You have completely.
Well, let's see. Who knows? Tomorrow it may suddenly appear again. You let me know if it does, because I wouldn't know it if it's really the ego.
Really? Because if you're acting in the ego, you don't even know it's the
ego. If you're really in the ego, you don't know it.
But how can that be so when what you teach us in A New Earth is that to be aware of it. And the more you're aware of it, you can say, because I've been able to see it. Oh,
yeah.
There's my ego.
Yeah.
There's my ego. Oh, there it is showing
yes.
up again. I see it. I see it. I see it. So there is an awareness.
Yes.
Because mine's still alive.
But that's already, the shift is already happening.
Yeah.
The awareness is there. You're not totally in the grip of it because
right.
the awareness arises also. But there are many others who are still totally in the grip of it.
So if you're totally in the grip of it, you can't be
yes,
aware
yes.
that it has
yes.
shown up. Finish this sentence. I believe in...
nothing in particular.
Oh, that cracks me up. That is an LOLer.
Chapter 6, Forgiveness. Forgiveness is giving up the hope that the past could be any different. It's accepting the past for what it was and using this moment and this time to help yourself move forward. For so many people, searching for peace and purpose, the most debilitating source of their pain has been the struggle to forgive. Having experienced the trauma of childhood abuse and personal betrayals at different points of my life, I have great compassion for anyone facing what might seem like an insurmountable hurdle. The journey to release all grudges, to relinquish the quest for revenge, and to let go of the fantasy of what might have been is one of the most difficult spiritual challenges we will ever face. But I promise you, it is also the most rewarding, because the other side of forgiveness is freedom. There was a time when I believed the act of forgiveness meant accepting the offender and by doing so, condoning the act. I didn't understand that the true purpose of forgiveness is to stop allowing whatever that person did to affect how I live my life now. I only began to see a different path for myself after an expert on The Oprah Winfrey Show, Dr. Gerald G. Jampolsky, shared his definition. He said, forgiveness is giving up the hope that the past could be any different. Those words gave me goosebumps then and now. This was a transcendent moment for me bigger than any kind of aha. I love this idea so much, I adopted it as my personal mantra. Accepting this principle as spiritual law took me to the next level of living my own best life. And if you watch Super Soul Sunday, you know that I continue to share it regularly. In return, the life experiences shared with me on Super Soul Sunday have allowed me to go deeper and expand further into how forgiveness functions. My hope is that you, too, will use the wisdom in this chapter to excavate where you need to forgive. When best-selling author and spiritual teacher Iyanla VanZant joined me on the show, I told her that I keep the lesson in forgiveness that she shared with me in a little book of quotes I've collected over the years. You can accept or reject the way you are treated by other people, she says. But until you heal the wounds of your past, you will continue to bleed. You can bandage the bleeding with food, with alcohol, with drugs, with work, with cigarettes, with sex, but eventually it will ooze through and stain your life. You must find the strength to open the wounds, stick your hands inside, pull out the core of the pain that is holding you in your past, the memories, and make peace with them. This speaks so clearly to me. Pushing against the need to forgive is like spreading poison in your veins. Surrender to the hurt, loss, resentment, and disappointment. Accept the truth. It did happen. And now it's done. Make a decision to meet the pain as it rises within you and allow it to pass right through. Give yourself permission to let go of the past and step out of your history into the now. Forgive and set yourself free. For this chapter, I want to share with you a heart-expanding, super soul conversation that reaches beyond forgiveness and taps into the healing power of mercy. Mercy isn't a word you hear a lot these days, but I believe it has the power to change the way we connect with every person we encounter. Attorney and advocate Brian Stevenson agrees. He has dedicated his life to pursuing justice for the underserved and wrongfully accused. During our talk, Brian described mercy as a mirror. He says, it's what you give to people who might not deserve it in the hope that it will come back to you. What would the world look like if every encounter we had started and ended with mercy?
I believe that what you're doing in your work and most recently in your book is that you're trying to actually speak to the super soul of America. You have a beautiful belief that can be summed up in one sentence. I love this sentence. It's something that I think every single person who's watching us, who's hearing us around the world can relate to. And that is, you are not the worst mistake that you've ever made.
That's right. Yeah. My clients have taught me that each person is more than the worst thing they've ever done. Because when I meet them through some accusation of something horrific and terrible. And what they teach me is that they're more than that crime. They're more than that worse act. And I really have come to believe that if someone tells a lie, they're not just a liar. If someone takes something that doesn't belong to them, they're not just a thief. Even if you kill somebody, you're not just a killer. And what a just and evolved and compassionate society has to do is to kind of figure out the other things you are and make sure we understand that part of each person.
I will have to say that before reading Just Mercy, I had this view of criminals. Like criminals are in a category. The prison system is in its category. So you need prisons because people commit crimes. And if they're committing crimes, they deserve to be in prison. And that's really not my problem because I'm not a person who's committing crimes. I will say that halfway through reading this, I literally felt my heart opening. And I will be forever changed at the way I look at people who are, quote, not like me, who are behind bars. I mean, that is what you did.
Well, thank you for that. I genuinely believe that if most people saw what I see on a regular basis, they would think differently about the world. They would really have a different understanding. And there are reasons why you felt that way. Lots of people feel that way.
Yeah.
It's because we've actually been taught and trained and pushed to think that way. I think for the last 40 years, we've all been a little bit corrupted by what I call the politics of fear and anger, where we quickly demonize other people. We've been told to be afraid. We've been told to be angry. We've kind of put these people in these institutions far away. We don't see them. We don't get to interact with them. And, you know, when you're afraid and you're angry, it's easier to kind of think things about people that may not be complete and fair. But it's also true that when you don't have to see it, when you're distant, it's easier to kind of imagine this world that is a world you don't have to kind of spend any time worrying about.
Which is exactly what I think is going on in our country right now, you know, where we see almost on a regular daily basis racism rearing its ugly head in ways that without body cams and cameras, a lot of people could not have imagined. So what is going on?
You know, I think that there is this presumption of guilt that gets assigned to black and brown people in this country. It's a presumption of dangerousness. And I think it's a result of our history of racial inequality that we've never adequately confronted, that we've have never adequately dealt with.
Yeah.
And we all carry this sort of implicit bias, and it manifests itself. It's become problematic because we're so anxious and we're so ready to judge one another.
Yeah. Those of us in the black community know that these things have been going on for years. There just weren't cameras to show you that they were going on.
Yeah.
And I was trying to explain it in this way. I have a fear of pit bulls.
Mm.
I love dogs.
Mm.
I have 5 dogs. Mm. I've had 21 dogs in my lifetime. Yeah. But I have a fear of pit bulls.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what you tell me about pit bulls. I have this conscious and unconscious belief that a pit bull will turn on me, a pit bull will hurt me, a pit bull will... That is my unconscious belief, whether that is true or not.
Yeah.
And I think that to many white people, many of them police officers, black men, brown men, are like pit bulls.
Mm-hmm.
Pit bulls.
I think the great evil of American slavery was not the involuntary servitude, was not the forced labor. I think the great evil of American slavery was the narrative of racial difference we created, the ideology of white supremacy we made up.
The idea that because your skin is white,
exactly,
you are better.
That's right. And we did that because slave owners wanted to feel moral and Christian and just while they owned other human beings. And to do that, they had to see these people they owned as less than human.
Yeah.
And our 13th Amendment doesn't deal with this narrative of racial difference. It doesn't deal with the ideology of white supremacy. That's why I argue that slavery didn't really end in 1865. It just evolved. It turned into decades where we had lynching and racial terrorism.
And Jim Crow.
And Jim Crow to support and sustain this racial hierarchy.
Okay. Can you explain this? Because the hardest thing, I think, for a lot of people who are not people of color, Caucasian people, to understand is why slavery has anything to do with now. That was the thing that always comes up. And even in my discussions with my friends who are not black, it's like, but I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
I didn't do anything. And that was then. So what has that got to do with me?
Well, I think part of it is that we are so quick to kind of see, is this safe for me to talk about this? So am I going to get blamed? And we put our defenses up. And that's not really what we need. We don't need to be blaming people. We need to just understand. And the way that slavery shifts...
How do we speak to the souls of each other without blame?
I think part of it is understanding how we got where we are and then making shifts. And so what I say to people about why that's relevant today is, so the whole demographic geography of this country was shaped by the racial terror that followed slavery. We have black people in Oakland and Los Angeles and Chicago, Cleveland, Detroit, New York, Los Angeles. And these people of color fled to these communities, not as immigrants looking for new opportunities. They fled as refugees from lynching and violence. And And for me, the ugliness of segregation wasn't just that you couldn't get, you know, you couldn't go to school, you couldn't vote. It was the humiliation. My parents were humiliated every day of their lives. Every time they saw that white and colored sign, they were burdened and beaten and marginalized. And it carries with you. There are injuries that come from that. And white people were misled, too, because they were taught that they're better than other people just because they're white. That's kind of child abuse. It's kind of a lie we give to children, and we haven't helped them recover. And so now this presumption of dangerousness and guilt is out there.
So we have the highest incarceration rate of any country in the world. And you say that this has fundamentally changed us as a nation. How is that?
Well, I think we've become a nation that basically throws you away without much thought. We've put a million people in jails and prisons for drug dependency. We decided to deal with drug dependency as a crime issue rather than a health issue. We declared a war on drugs. We took away a discretion. We called for mandatory sentencing. We competed with each other, politicians, on who could be the toughest on crime. And when you do that day in and day out, it does change you. I think it corrupts you. You actually lose your capacity to be compassionate. You lose your capacity to be merciful. And when you lose that capacity, you actually end up in a very bad place. And
but
we
do
are
we not
in a bad
need
place.
To be tough on crime? Do we? We're a society that needs to be tough on crime.
Most of the people we put in jails and prisons are not there because they're a threat to public safety. We did that because we were looking for ways to make ourselves look tough. No, the crime rate, the violent crime rate, is actually where it was in most communities in the 1960s, before we had 2.3 million people in jails and prisons. And one of the things we've done is we've actually disrupted communities. We've made it more likely that people will offend. I talk to 13 and 14-year-old boys in poor neighborhoods who tell me that they don't expect to be free by the time they're 21. And it's a tragic thing for me to hear. But that's what they see happening in their communities. They see their friends and their brothers and their neighbors effectively dying from being sent to prison or dying from drugs and gang warfare.
And it becomes an expected way of
life. Yes, exactly right. And that nothing is more tragic than the profound absence of hope, that believing that going to jail and prison is inevitable. And we have too many kids in our society living in the margins of society with this expectation of incarceration.
I appreciate it and hold such value for what the stories unfold about who we are as a country and how heart-opening it was for me that I think literally every person should read this book. I want every person to get this book. But I want to talk about how your work on death row, how that enhanced and emboldened your own soul. When you spend time in the harshest of places...
Yeah.
In the harshest of places where there is no hope.
Yeah.
You talk about the brokenness and how your connection to their brokenness also allowed you to see your own.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you put yourself in situations like this, you learn things. You learn about the power of hope. You know, you learn that you have to believe things that you haven't seen if you really want to change the world.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that I couldn't just have ideas in my mind about what I wanted to do. I needed to be informed. I needed to be strategic and tactical. But I also learned that I wasn't going to actually make a difference if the ideas in my mind weren't fueled by some conviction in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so you learn to kind of trust what your heart tells you about what you have to do. You learn to stand when everybody else is sitting. You learn to speak when other people are quiet, because you have to do the thing that advances justice, that advances what you believe in.
Okay. What are some of the worst cases?
The worst cases are children.
Are children. Ian.
Yes. I mean, my clients have gotten younger and younger.
Tell us the story of Ian.
Ian Manuel was a 13-year-old boy who was pretty much living in the streets. He was trying to get admitted to a gang. He was required to commit this robbery. He attempts a robbery. He shoots a woman in the side of the face. He's arrested. He's charged with attempted murder. He's told to plead guilty, and he'll get a 15-year sentence. He pleads guilty, and the judge gives him life without parole. He's so small when he gets to the adult prison that they don't have a uniform big enough for him. And the warden has to make a decision. Do I put this little 13-year-old boy in a dorm where he'll be preyed upon, or do I put him in solitary confinement? So they put him in solitary confinement. And the rules in solitary confinement is that you can't get out until you have a perfect 6 months. And because he was 13 and he was struggling and he was abandoned and he was neglected and he was in this horrific condition, he never had a perfect 6 months. So he spent 18 years in solitary confinement. He never touched another human being. He never got programs. He never saw anybody. When we started working with him, he had literally been in a cage in an isolated area for 18 years. And he's an amazing human being. He's bright. He writes incredible poetry. But he's also struggled. He cuts himself. He's attempted suicide multiple times. And helping him recover has been a great challenge, but it's also been a great privilege, because he takes someone who's been crushed and broken and thrown away and yet see that person capable of creating beauty an honest reflection, which he does powerfully in his poetry.
And you describe in Just Mercy many of your clients as broken people, and you say our society wants to execute or hide away all the broken ones. But you believe that we're all broken, really.
Yeah, I do. You know, I mean, it's
And it's our brokenness that defines our humanity.
It is. I mean, I think the truth of it is that we've all fallen down. We've all made mistakes. We've all hurt each other. And we want to recover from that. If we're a decent human being, we want to kind of get to a better place. And that's true for all the people who are incarcerated. And I think when we begin to recognize our own brokenness, we recognize our need, our obligation to help the broken recover. My clients are broken people. I work in a broken system. People, judges, prosecutors, everybody's been broken by their distance from the people that they're trying to and sometimes manage. And I think that means that we've got to think more honestly about what it means to be broken, what it means to have failed, what it means to fall down, but also what it means to stand up, to recover, to redeem ourselves and to redeem others.
So many of your clients have never experienced a moment of real compassion. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the name of the guy who was being executed and in the 14
Herbert
hours.
Richardson.
Can you tell me that
story?
Yeah,
Herbert Richardson was a Vietnam vet, came back traumatized from Vietnam, couldn't get the legal help he needed. I was back there with him right before the execution, and he was saying to me, all day long, people have been saying, what can I do to help you? Can we get you water? Can we get you coffee? Can we get you stamps to mail your last letter?
This is on the last day of his life.
Last day of his life. Can we get the phone for you? And I never will forget him saying to me in those last few, this was just about 30 minutes before the execution, he said, Brian, it's been so strange. He said, more people have said, what can I do to help you in the last 14 hours of my life than they ever did in the first 19 years of my life. And I was holding his hand, standing there with him, thinking, yeah, where were they when you were three, when your mom died? Where were they when you were seven and you were experimenting with drugs? Where were they when you were a young teenager returning from Vietnam, traumatized and drug addicted? And with those questions resonating in my mind, he was pulled away. And strapped in the electric chair and executed. And the shame of that, for me, was what I couldn't let go. You know, they had the guards come in and shave the hair off his body to prepare him for the execution, and I watched those men do that. And I don't think I'd ever seen human beings more pained by something they had to do than those guards. They all quickly, most of them, quit soon after. And just the pain and shame of that made me believe that we can do better. Then there are people like Jimmy Dill, who I write about in the book, who I'm having that conversation with right before they execute him, and he's intellectually disabled and he can't get his words out. And that was a moment for me, even though I wasn't present at the execution chamber, that was very hard. And I remember just standing there with tears running down my face, and that's when I began reflecting on my own brokenness.
Should the death penalty be banned in this country?
I think it should. And I think the reason for that is that the question of the death penalty isn't, do people deserve to die for the crimes they've committed? People commit some horrific crimes. I'm not going to dispute that. But I think the threshold question is, do we deserve to kill? And we have a system of justice that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Wealth, not culpability, shapes outcomes. We have a system.
Say that again.
We have a system of justice that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Wealth, not culpability, shapes outcomes. And we've never had more innocent people in jails and prisons than we have right now. We went from 300,000 people in jails and prisons in 1972 to 2.3 million people today, and that means we've never had more innocent people in jails and prisons than we have right now. We've had 154 people who were sentenced to death get exonerated, proved innocent. That means for every 9 people we've executed in this country, 1 innocent person has been proved innocent. It's a shocking rate of error.
But there are some people who don't deserve to ever set foot in society again.
That's absolutely true. But that doesn't mean we have to kill them. We have the capacity to incarcerate people for a really long time. It really isn't about what people deserve. It's about us. And part of the reason why I think ending the death penalty would be good for us is that it would liberate us from some of the worst parts of our history. You can't be in counties and communities where people have been lynched and threatened and menaced and terrorized and then have a person of color taken to death row. Our death penalty is very racially skewed. You're dramatically more likely to get it if the victim is white than if the victim is black. And if the defendant is black and the victim is white, then it's even much greater chance of getting the death penalty. It's a way in which we actually create a world where people can legitimately say black lives don't matter. Because we don't protect people who are poor, and we don't protect people of color in the same way we protect other people. And that's because we use all of our resources on expensive things like the death penalty at the cost of actually providing public safety to other folks.
And also corrupts the way we see each other. There's a particular incident that you describe in Just Mercy that struck me. You were going into a prison where there was a pickup truck outside and this guy had the Confederate flag. You're going to a courthouse.
Yeah, there was a bumper sticker on this truck I hadn't seen before. This bumper sticker read, quote, "If I'd known it was going to be like this, I'd have picked my own cotton." Hadn't seen that one before. Mm. And I went to the door, and there was a white guard at the door. And when he saw me, I said, "Hi, I'm here for a legal visit." He said, "You're not a lawyer." I said, "Oh, yes, sir, I am." He said, "Where's your bar card?" He actually made me go back to my car and get my bar card.
What state is this?
This is Alabama.
Alabama. Your state.
My state, yes. Okay. So I go get my bar card. I go up to him. I said, "Look, here's my bar card." He said, "Okay, well, you still have to go in the bathroom. I'm going to give you a strip search. This is where they strip you naked and do a body cavity search." I said, "No, lawyers don't get strip searched." He said, "You come into my prison, you're going to get in that bathroom." So I had to go in there and subject myself to a humiliating strip search. So then I come out and I said, "I want to go see the client." So you got to go back there and sign this book. I knew I didn't have to, but I did. I was about to go inside after he finally opens the door and he grabs me by the arm. He said, "Hey, did you see that truck out there?" I said, "Yeah, I saw that truck." He said, "I want you to know that that's my truck." So angered me. And I was sitting in the prison waiting for the client to come out. I was so
angry. This is just
angry.
A guard letting
just
you in the prison.
Yes, I wasn't expecting this. And then the client comes out and the first thing he says to me, I'd never met him before, young African-American man. He looks at me and he says, "Did you bring me a chocolate milkshake?" And I thought to myself, this is the strangest day I've had in a really long time. I said, "No, I didn't bring you a chocolate milkshake. I'm your lawyer. I'm here to represent you." And I started asking questions and he wasn't paying attention. I realized he was hung up on this milkshake. And so I finally said, "Look, I'm sorry. I didn't know you wanted me to bring you a chocolate milkshake. The next time I come, I'll bring you a milkshake." And this man smiled, horrific background, was in 29 foster homes by the time he was 10, severely mentally ill, schizophrenic, crack addicted, bipolar at 13, no medical care, homeless, and in the midst of a psychotic episode, commits a brutal crime, terribly defended at trial, gets the death penalty. We start working on the case, and finally it's time to go to court. And I see that guard, who I hadn't seen since, was the guard that brought him from the prison to the courthouse. And he's just glaring at me in this courtroom. We have 3 good days of court. I feel pretty good about the case. And a month later, I go see the client, and sure enough, there's the guard. He says, "Hello, Mr. Stevenson, how are you?" Kind of threw me. I said, "I'm fine." I said, "I'll go in the bathroom for you."
The same guy that had been so intimidating and had wanted you strip searched before.
Exactly, and who was in the courthouse when we had the hearing. And I said, "I'll go in the bathroom." He said, "Well, we're not going to do that today." I said, "Okay, I'll go over here and sign the book." He said, "Mr. Stevenson, I saw you coming and I signed you in." Trying to figure out what's going on. Right, exactly. So he takes me over to the door and trying to figure out what's happening. And he's trying to unlock the door and his hands start shaking so badly, he can't get the key in the lock. And I'm looking at him, and finally he gets the key in the lock. He unlocks the door. He turns to me. His face is red. He said, "Mr. Stevenson, I have to say something to you." I said, "What's that?" He said, "I was in that courtroom, and I was listening." He said, "I want you to know, I think what you're doing is a good thing." He said, "I hope you keep fighting for justice." Would have never predicted
Wow.
it. Put his hand out, and he said, "You know, I came up in the foster care system, too. I didn't think anybody had it as bad as I did, but maybe your client had it worse." He said, "Sir, can I please shake your hand? I hope you keep fighting for justice." I would have never, ever guessed it. And I walk inside.
Mr. Confederate flag man?
Mr. Confederate flag man. And I'm walking inside, finally, just kind of blown away. And he grabs me by the arm. He said, wait, I got to tell you something else. I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, I just want you to know I did something on the way back from the courthouse to the prison." I said, "What'd you do?" So I decided to take an exit, and I took your client to a Wendy's, and I bought him a chocolate milkshake. Would have never, ever guessed it.
Yeah.
And that just reminded me, even with my issues, that I have to be hopeful. I have to look for ways to embrace everyone, even those that have been misled and misdirected by this horrific history of racial inequality.
Wow. So, I mean, that's such an incredible story to me about what happens when an inmate, a quote, prisoner, gets humanized.
Yes.
How would you define mercy? Mercy is?
Mercy is like a mirror. I think mercy.